Right, so if you recall, like yesterday, we were talking about lattice models, right? And we had transformed our continuum Hamiltonian, which was well, second quantization is a little easier. So we had transformed this guy into just a different form. Right, so sometimes these are called hopping, but I like the name tunneling better, right? Because you can think of the T's as describing processes where the electrons moving around and then sometimes get over these potential barriers, right? And then kind of go to another orbital somewhere. And then, so today we're going to focus a lot more. We already did a little bit, but on the V and what kind of stuff is contained there. Okay. So here I've written the order of these operators such that if you did the spin sums and thought about I equals J, K equals L, these kind of look like an incident density interaction. But you know, electrons are up to more than that, right? They kind of also will sort of switch places virtually, and then you get exchange effects. So that also is contained in here. So we saw that by focusing on a particular one, right? So there's this whole sum over I, J, K, L, but we can imagine fixing different subsets of these IJKL values. And remember, well, I should ask you guys, what are these letters IJKL run over? This is a question to anybody out there. So, right, so if I think about I taking different values, what if you go all the way back down to like microscopics involving atoms and different, you know, atoms, like we have oxygen atoms, maybe in transition metal atoms.
So,
yeah, I heard orbitals, right? So Vanier orbitals, right? So these are where we take a band and then we kind of do some kind of sum over a bunch of states in this band that are all rather delocalized. And we can get some kind of constructive and destructive interference, and we can bunch up all the weight onto one near one particular atom, right? Yes?
I don't need to actually start with bands. I can start with, like, you know,
What was the question? Like,
so I don't actually need to go to start in K space and then move backwards. Like, I could just
right.
Start with CI signals being like, you know, like being defined as some localized orbital with some overlap, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So the question is, why can I not just start with the atomic orbitals?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of one of these things if you start with enough orbitals that's complete enough, you can always make linear combinations. And, you know, it's just saying like that there's a lot of different bases out there. So I just mentioned this story as a way to connect to last week, basically. It's a big reason why I'm kind of saying that first you could do a band structure calculation and then, you know, move toward a lattice model, partly because I wanted kind of the tone of that to be that you can build in a lot of interaction. So that's one lesson I wanted you guys to take away, is that you can build in a lot of interaction effects into the band picture, right? In a way that's principled too. It's not just some kind of mean field, right? It's way beyond mean field. It even has an exact limit. It's just a bit of a pie in the sky exact limit. But then you see, so you can basically chop off a big chunk of the problem just by what orbitals you make. So you can do the atomic orbitals, but you can do kind of get better orbitals, is what I'm saying. And so then you get a lot of nice stuff for free. So you can actually get a lot of crystal field effects sort of built in to the local T's, and you can, you know, otherwise you might have to do a little bit more analysis to see those, things like that. Yeah, there's sort of many reasons. Basically, maybe these T's and V's behave better if you can build them out of sort of better orbitals. So they might be more short-ranged. So one of the V's was where we freeze, you know, we kind of lock IJKL certain values together. So we want to lock them in this pattern, so VIJJI. But then we want to do the sum over spin. And this was the, this is going to be something we're going to call Coulomb exchange. The contrast will be clear when we discuss kinetic exchange in a minute. And then you're going to work with this kinetic exchange in the tutorial. And we saw that that if you group now the common orbital labels together, you get a minus sign and some other terms that we're not so interested in, or just one other term that's some kind of correction to a potential. Maybe it's a little clearer if I put the sums like this. Maybe not. Okay. Right? So the idea is that this is something that can flip spins, right? So the I here is the same orbital, and the sigmas are sometimes the same, but you know, also can be different. So there's some spin flipping that can happen, right? So to see this a little better, basically, it's just an exercise. I mean, it's a bit of a long and tedious one, so I didn't want to do it all the way on the board. But this can be further written as so this is just simply manipulating operators. And here, SK, I shouldn't use K because that sort of seems like momentum, even though we used it up there. SL is defined as right. And we talked about how this is a little different from what you may think about with spin, right? This is just a definition because often we think of spins as just sort of being tied down, right? But these are spins that can sort of disappear sometimes or come back, or maybe the site can be doubly occupied and then they could be sort of quenched, right? So there's a little, it's a little bit funnier, and that's why you also have this term as well. So here we're in a bigger Hilbert space than just the space of spins. But you can imagine certain physical situations just due to energy constraints where you're saying maybe the ground state, this local moments develop, but we'll see an argument for that in a minute. And so then this is just some constant in that case if the densities are just held at one. So this is there, but you know maybe it's just some constant energy shift. And so then we really do develop actual spin interactions. And notice, importantly, the sign. And let's go back also and write an expression now for VIJJI. So so we get basically effectively interaction like minus JH SI dot SJ, where we find that
if you're going to have a minus sign at the front, you get a minus sign on the NIMJ as well.
There is an expression that comes up in the TJ model, I think, where there's a minus sign here. But this, I kind of went carefully through this, and pretty sure that's the right sign of the density. Anyway, maybe this can be something you can check. Be a good exercise. That's not even the most important term, though, so just focusing on the S part. And so maybe this one isn't so illuminating, but it's worth just writing one time. And you'll see it kind of looks a little bit like when you do Hartree-Fock and you get this exchange energy. So it's really related to that. That's an I, this is a J. Okay, so you know I'm saying that this thing is I want to say that this thing is generally ferromagnetic, but it's not so, so it's sort of obvious if you think of J as positive, but it's not so obvious from this formula that it's positive. But I'm just going to leave it as a claim that you can show that generally this is positive. And so, for instance, there's a nice argument in the book by Auerbach that shows that that when the potential is ultra short range, this is positive, and also when the potential is like super long range, this is positive. And so then this is sort of just an argument that maybe in between it's positive too, and then this can be made a little bit more rigorous or careful. Or you could just check it for sets of orbitals for real systems. So in general, this is positive J, and so then there's a minus sign. So this is ferromagnetic. And the argument here is that this happens for, this is the most important when these orbitals are spatially close by, right? So we think of, say, two different orbitals belonging to the same atom, or, you know, kind of descending from the same atom's orbitals. And so then there's a tendency for spins occupying different orbitals on the same atom to want to line up. And so this is often known as Hund's first rule. So there's a whole sort of semi-heuristic business of if you start with degenerate orbitals on atoms, and then you put them into some crystalline environment, and you want to figure out sort of what's the fate of all these orbitals. So there's all these different mechanisms for splitting, and they all compete with each other, and it's pretty messy business, actually. But one rule that holds pretty strongly is that when you fill these now split levels, you first want to fill them, you fill different levels, and you keep all the spins parallel. Then you start filling the other way. So usually the picture you get is something like this. You'll have a bunch of split levels, and then you start filling in electrons like this. And then you start filling in like this. This is coming from this physics, right? And
so normally you want to be degenerate, right? Because if you've got competition between the spins and that.
Well, it depends on how you kind of go through the story. So here I'm thinking of these as being split from various mechanisms, like crystal field effects and Yontelller distortions. And, these all kind of compete. There's also Coulomb splitting that can happen, Yeah, you can get different things, but so here I'm not even saying what these levels are, like in terms of which particular d orbitals they are or something. I'm just thinking of d orbitals. But this is just sort of a lesson to say that this, for instance, is you may have wondered how do you get different kinds of spin in systems. So how is it that we put in electrons that have spin a half, but we can end up with spin models that have, say, spin one moments? Like how does this happen? Right? This could be an example of how this happens. So this is something, this could be, for instance, a nickel atom, right? I believe it's like nickel 2+. So basically, it can give away two of its electrons to some, like an oxygen atom or something, or a sulfur atom. And then what you end up with is two sort of unpaired electrons. And then this can affect, but they're locked together very strongly by this kind of interaction. And so this can lead to an effective spin one. This can happen, right? So there's a particular material, nickel gallium sulfide, where this happens. All right.
Still, what justification did you use again to drop out the Hubbard term?
Yeah, but just this density interaction term. I didn't really give an argument for why. I guess basically you could argue that local moments could form due to other effects. Like there could be a U also that we didn't really talk about. So that could sort of trap the electrons on these orbitals. And then their density just isn't fluctuating very much. So this term is there, but it's there in some like sort of classical level, where the fact that it's made out of operators doesn't really matter anymore. It just becomes like a C number that's added on to the energy. And that's sort of a very, you know, literally waving my hand, you know. There's this thing called the TJ model where you take into account that spins can sort of disappear off sites and you can end up with holes and things like this, right? And then there's a term like that, maybe with a different sign, that can be important. Question?
When you wrote those lines with the arrows in them, are the lines organized by energy?
Yeah, that's the idea.
And so now it's actually, but is it energetically favorable to have them all split out with Hund's rule like this then? I mean, because it would seem like if I had the last two instead of both be up in this one and then a higher energy, why would I not want both?
Yeah. So there's an energy that is you can see in the picture, and there's another energy that you cannot see in the picture. So good question, right? So if all you're thinking about is purely this is nice because the picture only shows like part of the story, right? So that picture, by drawing the line split like that, I was indicating that there's some kind of single particle, like single electron physics that's happening, right? Yeah. Due to a variety of different mechanisms involving the neighboring, you know, atoms and things like that, that will split these levels, but only if you kind of probed these levels of the single electron at a time. You would find that there's different states one electron could be in that would cause different energies, but they're also interacting with each other, right? And you need to have more than one electron for that effect to kick in, and that's the effect I was focusing on is the spin interaction.
So if they didn't interact at all with each other, then
They would just fall.
This picture would show they just fall into whatever
exactly. Exactly. So it's a bit of a surprising thing, because just from the picture, if someone didn't tell you what that picture meant and just said, you know, fill this thing with electrons, you would just have filled it up from the bottom, right? But instead, you saw I kind of filled it up first in a really crazy way, you know, going through all the levels and not taking advantage of these other, what it looked to be lower levels, because of this very strong spin interaction that can take place.
There's a pretty cool effect you can get in, like, inorganic chemistry, where if you take, I want to say something that's an octahedral, like you take a complex molecule, which has got like a metal atom in the center and a bunch of atoms on the side. You can change, by changing the atoms on the side, like if you change it from, say, water to, I want to say, carbon monoxide, that changes it. Carbon monoxide is like a really strong bonding, which gives it, which really increases this crystal splitting strength. And that will, and then the water bonds really weakly. And so I think with water, if you've got octahedral bonding, it's small enough that you generally see spins align, you get like a really ferromagnetic state. You change them into carbon monoxide, which you can do in the lab, and you'll find that your magnetism drops way down. So when it's like really dark.
Like you mean these will compete and it'll switch?
They compete. And you can actually switch them in the lab. Like
yeah,
you can
exactly.
change that crystal.
So none of these rules are hard and fast. There's sort of all these different orderings of the rules, and it can depend quite sensitively on all kinds of details. So. But this can happen, and then maybe I should have drawn a little like line connecting the spins to say, okay, they're interacting. But I think you got that picture, so that's cool. So yeah, these can switch.
Yeah.
The order of these energies can actually switch around.
Yeah,
and you can lead to.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you can see this happening, right? Even weirder things can happen where you can have where they can end up being nearly degenerate, and then you can get orbital ordering where there can be other effects where basically on one spatial, like in one unit cell, one orbital is actually picked, and in another unit cell, a different orbital is picked, and so on and so forth. So you can have this kind of staggered orbital selection through a material that can happen sort of spontaneously to energy for energy reasons. So there's all kinds of sort of a zoo of phenomena that can happen in these like transition metal compounds. It's very involved. So all right, so Coulomb exchange. Again, remember that was because what are these electrons trying to do by lining up their spins like that? They're trying to statistically avoid each other and lower their very strong Coulomb repulsion. We're talking about electrons that are nearby spatially, right? So there's another kind of exchange that can happen called kinetic exchange. And I'm going to give a somewhat more sketchy argument for this because I don't want to like spoil too much of the tutorial, right? So in the tutorial, your job is to go through this a little more carefully using a bit more math, right? So this is just going to be a bit more of like writing some toy model and just saying some words kind of argument. Here this first argument was basically we just picked out a term in this lattice model. And this term does involve a certain amount of kinetic energy effects already because of the existence of these orbitals in some sense. But here it's even more of an interplay between kinetic and Coulomb. Okay, we'll say in interactions. So kinetic plus potential, really, because it's like tunneling, right? So remember, tunneling, these T's really always involve the sort of bare microscopic kinetic energy and also the existence of some background potential, like, say, the nuclear potentials and other average potentials from the other electrons and things like this, right? And so the minimal model for this kind of particular exchange is this thing you could call the two-site Hubbard model. We'll sort of introduce the full Hubbard model later, but this is just, think of it as some kind of model that's just mathematically only rich enough just to see this effect and not bring in any other effects we don't want to focus on. right? So we already talked, we've been talking about that there's these t's, and here we're thinking there's t's to all distances in principle. And in fact, the second neighbor, third neighbor t's can actually be extremely important in practice. Here we're just saying, let's just think about a first neighbor t, right? And we're thinking inside a particular band, right? So this just means that maybe connects one sort of active orbital to the one over the next unit cell. And then there's this u, which is the cost for doubly occupying an orbital, right? And it's always important to remember, sometimes people call these sites, and mathematically they're like little sites, but they really involve, they're really orbitals, right? So this u is really some integral over some kind of semi-spread out orbital living on some atom. And we want to think about the limit where t is much, much less than u. So this is this like, you know, moderate to strong, actually strong correlation limit, right, where the u is exceeding the bandwidth. So remember, there's this emergent energy of this band scale, and then the u can actually exceed that. And so then it sort of, you know, things can rearrange. So the lowest energy states are going to want to avoid doubly occupying any of these sites, these two sites, right? So again, the picture here is like two sites or two orbitals, and there's a u and then this t, right? So the t wants them to hop back and forth. The u just wants them to stay away from each other, right? We want to put two electrons of opposite spin into this system. Maybe I'll draw these as buckets, right? And so this is where the hand-wavy stuff comes in, right? So basically, let's just say that, let's just sort of make up trial wave functions. So let's just say, okay, two decent wave functions could be and here I'm just going to write the way like a chemist would write it, so kind of in first quantized notation. Okay, times some spin part. Right, so we think our choices are either a singlet, or let's think of a mz equals zero triplet. Right, so it's either up, down, minus, down, up, or up, down, plus, down, up. Here I'm just thinking of being in the kind of total SZ equals zero subspace, but it doesn't matter that much. I mean, you could also think about the other triplets, but it's not so important for what I'm going to say. So basically, without further ado, if you... if you compute the matrix elements, so I told you this would just be a lot of words, right? Because I didn't want to spoil any math for your tutorial. So if you compute matrix elements psi A, H, psi B, and maybe also overlaps, because depending on what orbitals you make this thing out of, they may not automatically, A and B here are taking values plus or minus, right, these two guys, then they may not be orthogonal depending on what size you put in there, so you have to remember that. Yeah.
In the minimal model that you wrote,
yeah.
There's no pressure against having the two sites both spin up, right? Those are the same energy.
That's fine, yeah, exactly. So there's nothing really wrong with that. So I'm just thinking here of, let's just constrain ourselves though to the case where the total spin is zero, just for sort of, just so we have only two wave functions to discuss.
Okay.
But they could still be sort of virtually aligned in the sense of being in the triplet state. So just if like you turn your head now, they're like aligned. You know what I mean? It's just a rotation away from just being spins pointing in the same direction, in some sense. Yeah.
So if you have the spins aligned, you get problems with the kinetic energy being zero because they can't hold.
Yeah, that's the point coming up, exactly. So, yeah, but that'll even come up here when they're sort of virtually aligned even. So that's sort of the very next thing, to say that that basically, without showing you the math, if you just diagonalize this, you know, now this little 2x2 matrix, keeping in mind that, you know, they're also not necessarily orthogonal, so you have to fix that up when you do the diagonalization. So it's like a generalized eigenvalue problem. You find that the lower energy of the two is psi plus, okay? Right, so that's the spatially symmetric. and importantly, spin anti-symmetric. Okay, and so the story here that you hear about why this happens is that basically you imagine now these guys are making virtual trips back and forth between the two sites. So this is the usual picture you see drawn. So you think about this kind of situation, and you know, the dominant effect is they want to stay apart, right? But you basically, when you do perturbation theory, so you can do perturbation theory in T over U, what can happen is you get virtual processes where this guy can pay a visit to that site, right? And it'll pay some energy denominator of U, but it'll gain something, some energy involving T, okay? And so they can only do this, right, only possible if the spins are anti-aligned, right? Just because of Pauli exclusion. So that's really the theme of all these different exchange interactions, right? So the Coulomb exchange interaction, right, that's more of a sort of a direct kind of interaction. Direct is the wrong word because that's used sometimes to mean Hartree-like. But direct in the sense of it's sort of just sitting there in the lattice model we wrote down. That one, again, has to do with Pauli exclusion, right? Because by keeping the spins parallel, they can use Pauli exclusion to their advantage to avoid paying some Coulomb energy. Here, Pauli exclusion also is the key mechanism. But what it's gaining is it's not that it's saving Coulomb energy, it's gaining kinetic energy. Kinetic in the sense of some kind of T-related energy, right? And it can do that if the spins are anti-aligned. So that's the kind of cartoon level argument. And again, it can be made, you know, more rigorous by actually doing trial wave functions, or in the tutorial you'll do perturbation theory and see this, and actually get an expression for how much energy is gained in even the form of the interaction. Okay? And I should emphasize the interaction that comes out is actually spin rotation invariant in this case, and you'll see that. Okay, so any questions about these two exchange mechanisms, right? Coulomb exchange, kinetic exchange, okay? So just wanted to, you know, because that's what yesterday and today are about, right? It's sort of like tomorrow, maybe end of today, we're gonna go towards more like cartoon lattice models because those have very interesting physics. So there the focus is less on the model and more on like what physics can come out of even rather simple models. But I just wanted to you guys to have this message that lattice models don't just come out of the air, right? You can just write ones down, and that's an interesting thing to do. But there's also a whole business of sort of connecting them back to microscopics. Oh, yeah, I should mention that also, well, I kind of said this yesterday, but again, you get a spin interaction of the form here, J S1 dot S2. And the point is that this number can be very large, right? So in units of temperature, this can be hundreds or even more of kelvins, okay? And if you actually compare to direct spin-spin interactions that happen just because of the tiny magnetic fields that a spin and a half gives off, like so dipolar interactions, say, compare this to dipolar, maybe is only sort of like one or let's just say one kelvin, okay? So basically, we wouldn't see magnetism, you know, unless we made things extremely cold and went to very special systems where kinetic energy effects, say, weren't so important, just from this mechanism. So the reason we see robust magnets is because of these sort of emergent spin interactions, right? So this is really important for why do we see magnets at room temperature or, you know, at sort of moderately low temperatures and things like this. So really, it's interesting. It's not the spins are somehow directly talking, but they're just doing everything they can kind of to avoid each other, but somehow still run around the system. And so there's some competition, and that leads to spin interactions.
Come on.
Yeah?
This is the Hubbard model that you've written down, that's a pretty good model for the hydrogen bond, isn't it?
Yeah. That's a good comment. Right. So that model looks really stripped down, but it actually can be, in fact, totally basically numerically exact for a certain, for the H2 molecule in the limit that the two atoms are stretched very far apart. So in that limit, it becomes asymptotically exact if you calculate the U and the T from first principles, like from doing actual integrals over orbitals. Yeah.
What other effects do you have to take into account if you want to model the hydrogen atom? Is it you need to account for like the interaction with the electrons on the different sites?
Like if you want to really model the whole thing at all distances? I would think there'd be virtual processes up into other excited states of each one, for instance, say. So just having one orbital just isn't going to cut it on each side, for instance. That's probably the most important, I would guess.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, so keeping with our theme of like not doing too much actual math, but just showing some models and then not solving them. So let's talk about super exchange. This is, I wanted you guys just to have more of a cartoon picture of where these things come from. I think that's kind of more important than drowning in a lot of math. But if you want to see the math, there's some really nice notes by Eric Koch, and I highly encourage you guys to look at these. So they have amazing pictures of Vanier orbitals. That alone is a good reason to look at these notes, just so you'll see and be convinced that when people draw little d orbitals on chalkboards and in slides, that if you actually look at the things going into these ab initio calculations, they really look like that spatially in 3D. The slides or the notes are actually a chapter of a book. The whole book is free online, and I'll post on the wiki probably too. Okay, so take a look at those. So there's actually, so this here we talked about this kind of simple model where you imagine some T that just directly connects to orbitals, but many materials the active orbitals are connected by some spacer atom, I guess you could call it. So a picture would be just a total cartoon picture, would be like this. Right, where you have some kind of d orbitals that we're thinking of as like our active ones, and these are the ones that we want to model and then add correlations to, meaning we want to really treat the interaction effects in some kind of quantum level, not just through some kind of mean field level. And then, but the idea is that these guys are not sort of directly connected by a very strong T, so there's not a very large T that connects them. Rather, there's a T that might connect an electron over to this p orbital of, say, an oxygen atom that spaces them, or make a sulfur atom, and then also a T here. And then, but yet, we can still have spin interactions that can arise in a situation directly between these two. And so let's just think about how this can happen. So here, the minimal model is a little more complicated. And I'll just draw it as a sort of picture with levels. So you can have levels that are split. And then the levels coming from these d orbitals can have a very strong u. So we should think of that as basically the strongest thing around. Okay. And again, this has a very strong u because of this thing I said where, say, 3d orbitals can be really tightly bound to the atom. They don't have to be as spread out radially to be orthogonal to the other guys. So in general, they can be very tightly bound, and they can have very large u's and also very small t's, so that the u is relatively even more important. And so let's think about adding electrons to the system like this. And then let's think about tunneling happening only here. So we don't focus on, there's maybe a very weak but sort of negligible tunneling directly between these orbitals, these two distant d orbitals, right? So they only tunnel here. So there's some tunneling, say, T, P, D. And then we have this on-site repulsion. And then there's these different levels. We could say these are at some energies, E, D, EP, okay. So,
what kind of scale are you thinking about with EP minus EP?
I just wanted to mention that that's there, but I think we should think of that as pretty weak. So it just kind of will end up correcting, it's like some small correction to the exchange interaction that comes out. But don't quote me on that. I didn't look into that too carefully. Without really doing any analysis of this, I just wanted to tell you guys this is the setup so you know what sort of microscopic interactions are there. But basically, the real low energy subspace. So, you know, a lot of processes can happen, but the low energy subspace is the one where, say this, let's call this guy one, is like I equals one, I equals two, is where ni up, ni down is just zero. Okay, so this is where we pay no u, d. Okay, was there a question out there? Okay, and then you know, just again, just to kind of give you guys the punchline right away, what you find is that if you project h into this low energy subspace, and this is where I just, you'll see why I didn't go through all this if you look at these notes. There's like these huge, you know, 9 by 9 matrices with tons of elements. That's just for one of the possible symmetry subspaces. But then in the end, the analysis is very clean. You basically just take this big matrix and you just apply some projection matrices on it. And then what you find is that this thing just transforms into a spin interaction. Okay, so it's just like the one we got over there. But I just wanted you to know that there's a different mechanism happening here. So it's not that there's a T directly connecting these guys and that they gain kinetic energy that way. There's something more complicated going on involving virtual hops to some kind of P orbitals shared between them. And the actual expression for the J, there's a more complicated one. But here I've suppressed the spacing in the expression. The expression is roughly this T to the 4 over U D to the 3. Okay. So that also kind of gives you the feeling that this is relatively weaker than this kind of more direct kinetic kinetic exchange where there's a T connecting these guys.
And specifically, that's anti-fermi, right?
Yes, greater than zero, so anti-ferromagnetic. Is that what you were asking?
Yeah.
Okay, the board was going out, so it was a little bit noisy. Okay, what's the intuition for just this result that I'm quoting, right? So basically, it's, you can draw it in one picture. So kind of ignoring now the spacing of these levels or anything, let me just draw them as being straight across, right? So this P level is some kind of, you know, kind of lower energy thing. We want to keep this doubly occupied, and these spins are anti-aligned. So we want to just know what choice of these outer D spins can let us gain the most kinetic energy. And remember, they only gain kinetic energy by tunneling just to the P and not directly to each other. So basically, these electrons can tunnel off, right? So say, you know, this one can tunnel off. That's OK, right? Pauli exclusion doesn't prevent this tunneling from happening. And then this tunneling can also happen as well, if this one has the opposite spin of that one, right? That's basically the picture, right? So if this one had the same spin, that wouldn't hurt this tunneling, but then this one couldn't happen. So basically, that would also be lowered in energy somewhat if this one had the same spin, and now this one is blocked, right? That would be, you know, okay, but the point is we can do better, right? So you can do even better by having the spin flip down, then both processes can happen, and you can gain even more kinetic energy in the system, right? So these virtual tunnelings get sort of turned on and unblocked, and that's basically the argument, right? So it's just a very hand-wave argument, but it does actually give the right result. You know, this can be done more carefully.
Spreading one electron over three orbitals is less energy efficient than spreading two electrons over two orbitals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's right. So basically, it's just you want both of these electrons to be able to participate in this tunneling process. You want to gain both of these T's instead of somehow only gaining just one of them, something like that. OK, so there's actually really a bunch of other processes, OK? So in fact, again, if you go look at those notes, there's a big figure just that has, like, I think, like 9 different processes that can happen when the spins are anti-aligned. I just drew sort of one of them, right? Because you can also imagine more complicated things where maybe this one hops off and another one hops on and some other things like that, right? So here I just thought about the P electrons just hopping off only, right? So there's many more processes, and that's yet another reason why this is a very favored arrangement of the spins. You know, again, if we align the D spins, there could be a few processes, just not as many, and they wouldn't gain as much kinetic energy, right? Okay, so that's called 180 degree. super exchange. All right, so it may seem that like, okay, all these different kinetic exchanges give you anti-ferromagnetic interactions, so that seems to be just the rule at this point. But you can actually get ferromagnetic interactions at a distance as well, right? So we saw you can get very strong ferromagnetic interactions directly kind of near or on the same atom, but you can also get them through these spacer atoms. So there's another thing called 90 degree super exchange. All right, so this looks cartoonishly like the following arrangement. All right, so this is some px orbital, py orbital. This is some particular d orbital. And then, say down here, there's another similar d orbital. All right. So similar to what I drew before, except now this guy has some strong tunneling to a particular p orbital of some spacer atom. This guy has strong tunneling, but to a different p orbital of the same spacer atom. Okay. Okay. So then just. Even more sketchily, let's just draw our minimal model in this kind of pictorial way. I don't know if that's a word, but I'll say sketchily. All right. I'm just labeling these px and py, but that's not an interaction. U is a strong on-site repulsion. And then the t's that we have are like this. You know, again, there's sort of always other T's, but they may just be much weaker and sort of very subleading effect. And then, importantly, there's one of these J's of the type that we talked about, this on-site Coulomb exchange, right? So the idea is that, so now there's some kind of combination of both of the things that we've talked about, right? So there's kinetic exchange where there's this effect where hops, you know, electrons want to hop and they want to be unblocked when they hop so they can actually take advantage of some kinetic energy gain. But then there's some other dynamics happening inside, not dynamics, but sort of interactions happening just on this spacer atom, right, which we can represent as J. So this is ferromagnetic, right? But it only kicks in if there's actually local moments, like if there's actually spins on these two sites, right? So there has to be a situation where there's an unpaired electron on each of these levels to be able to gain this J, right? So basically, we can see that happens when, right? So let's imagine sending off, say, a down from here, and then that leaves this up, right? And then over here, we want to leave also an up so that we gain this J, right? So we want to send off the down over here. Right, so that tells us that for this to be able to gain this J simultaneously, as well as gaining these T's, right? So what kind of spin should this be to keep this pathway unblocked? Right, so be up so that these can virtually share that site, and then similarly, what about over here? Right? Yeah, up again, right? So that this is unblocked. So basically, that's the idea, is that if you then sort of integrate out or do perturbation theory and treat these all as virtual, all these processes, you end up with this being ferromagnetic. Okay. So again, there's other processes that can gain the T's but don't buy you this J, right? So that's the idea. So this particular process gains you the T's in the sense of you let these hoppings happen, so you kind of open up those channels, but in a way that when they happen, this J also gets gained sort of virtually, right? So that gives you some sense that there's now a sort of competing processes here, some which gain this J, some which don't. So this is ferromagnetic, but it can be weaker, right, than this anti-ferromagnetic 180 degree version. Okay? Right? So just wanted you guys to know that this is also something that can happen in real materials. So this example I mentioned of this material, nickel gallium sulfide, this actually happens. So you have microscopically two sort of unpaired electrons that form a strong spin one moment, and then they're actually arranged spatially with spacer atom at what's roughly a 90 degree angle between them, maybe exactly a 90 degree angle. It's sort of a difficult 3D pattern. But basically, they have a ferromagnetic first neighbor interaction, but then interestingly, they have a anti-ferromagnetic third neighbor interaction, in fact. And this was found from a DFT calculation. So people can do DFT calculations where they can sort of populate the system with different fillings of different spins and sort of try to observe which pattern of spins gives the lowest energy. And then by fiddling with the spins in the system, they can actually back out different J's, effective J's. So this can all be actually done in DFT. So DFT is actually a big source of figuring out these different J's, even these kind of kinetic, these J's that originate from sort of kinetic effects, like these super exchange J's.
What material did you say this
is in? Nickel gallium sulfide. It's an interesting material. So this material, it also is thought to have what's called biquadratic interactions. So this is like an S dot S squared interaction that I haven't talked about where that comes from. So this is very interesting, and it seems not to order at low temperatures as well.
If I take my just a single spacer atom with 183 super exchange, if I put two spaces in between instead of one. So like, you know, kind of my intuition would say that that would decrease the ferromagnetic interaction because, you know, they're spread further apart. But then suddenly I've got like more atoms in between that can undergo the hopping. What does that do to the coupling?
Yeah, I just have to say I've not thought about that. That actually is discussed for this nickel gallium sulfide material. Okay. There's that same paper, so I could just point you to this paper. I mean, it's gonna be hard for me to think about like what would that. Yeah, I'm not gonna even hazard a guess of like what sign it would be. But yeah, this can happen, right? So you can actually have quite distant exchange pathways. So this is important. Maybe that's the important connection back to this thing I said about that. If you would have thought that spin interactions are somehow spins directly talking to each other, you know, say by their magnetic fields or something like that, you wouldn't think that you would have, say, a situation where you could have first neighbor spin interactions in some lattice, and then maybe also very strong third neighbor interactions, but say no second neighbor interactions. That wouldn't make sense, right? It would always be first strongest, second is next strongest, third, you know, just like that. But this can actually happen in these materials due to these sort of angle effects through spacer atoms. So these can actually give you different signs. So if it goes at a 90 degree angle or at a 180 degree angle. Also, there can be symmetry effects that I'm not gonna talk about, where some of these interactions can be sort of shut off. So just because of some symmetry where two orbitals are orthogonal, these processes just don't contribute anything. So you might actually have, where say a second neighbor interaction, meaning, you know, just spatially 2d orbitals away, can just be basically sort of tuned to zero just by some particular crystal, you know, geometries and things, and then processes like these. But then all of a sudden, the third neighbor interaction may be again very strong. And so it just has to do with all this kind of perturbation theory and these different pathways of kinetic and Coulomb energies intermixing. And again, these can be very strong, you know, many tens or hundreds of, or even more Kelvin. So we can see this phenomena, you know, close to room temperature. And that's a really nice result compared to the just direct spin interaction energies, which are quite small. Okay, so that's just a bit of microscopics yesterday and today. So now we're gonna, for the rest of the week, kind of leave microscopic world behind, right? So microscopic here meaning like connecting to ab initio things. So now we're gonna go to sort of lattice world, so like theory land a little bit, right? So the philosophy here is that you really can build models that really describe real materials. And there's different ways of doing this, right? So right now the program is probably a bit of, you know, you go through all these arguments, but it's a bit heuristic. Then you treat all these, you leave a lot of these interactions in, the ones that you reason to be most important. But then you kind of think of them as fitting parameters on some level, because it's just too hard to get them numerically exactly. Then people, you know, do heroic things to try to solve, or at least understand qualitatively what these models do, based on sort of a hierarchy of, you know, which interactions are important. That's one philosophy. Another one that I think might happen more and more in the future is this kind of quantum chemistry philosophy of like, let's use powerful computers and intelligent algorithms to really keep, you know, everything, like really try to keep sort of everything involving the active orbitals. But then the third route is just to say, okay, all this was we wanted to understand what kinds of models just to write down. And then now we just, you know, detach a little bit from worrying about the specific numbers, and we just, you know, we just get some signs, and we just sort of think about what are the important terms. And this leads us into these kind of, you know, qualitative models, right? So the most important one of these, in the sense of the one that's discussed a lot, is the Hubbard model, right? Again, important here doesn't mean it actually describes some particular material that we know, although it sort of does describe certain materials with like copper oxygen planes decently well. But really, it's like an attempt, I would think mostly it's an attempt by theorists to sort of get a handle on strongly correlated physics by writing down a simple looking model.
We don't know it describes the importance
of copper oxygen planes. You're saying we do know that, or?
We don't
really know. Yeah, the Hubbard model is, I mean, I'll say the Hubbard model is a bit of an embarrassment for the field, because it looks simple and it's really resisted a lot of attempts to understand it. Okay, but we'll try to understand like pieces of it, all right? Certain regimes. It's important also to understand, again, kind of where spin models come from, certain important spin models, right? So the Hubbard model is basically a very drastic simplification. Well, I'm not going to say it's always drastic. It just depends on the situation. But it's a simplification. Okay. Again, it can actually be correct, but it's in general, you need to add other things. And this is just where, you know, we've talked about what kind of T's and B's are running around out there. This is where you just keep one T and then you keep one V, which is the one we call U. All right, so it's a very difficult model. It's difficult, but it has very rich behavior. Some of this behavior may be like too rich in the sense of it may be like a bit special to this kind of overly simple model. It may be that as soon as you add, say, some second neighbor hopping or something, which would be there in probably most, you know, real materials, that some of this special behavior may just immediately disappear. So some of it may be a little bit special, but that's sort of a question we don't know always. And the behavior can depend quite a lot on sort of what dimension you're in, right? And I don't say that as some kind of flight of fancy. It's actually mainly intended to describe 2D systems, in fact. So there are these parent compounds for the high TC cuprate materials, where it's believed that the most important physics actually happens in two-dimensional copper oxygen planes. So that really is like it's believed by some people to be really be 2D, truly 2D physics, essentially, right? So when people study this in 2D, it's not a theorist toy in that sense. I mean, that really might be the right way to describe those materials. So dimensionality is one big consideration, and also lattice. I guess you could say geometry, you know, the connectivity of the lattice. This can have, I mean, this isn't just true for the Hubbard, right? This is true for like any lattice model, essentially. But I just mean that the reason people write down the Hubbard model is they want to understand these effects of like lattice geometry and connectivity, dimensionality, through the simplest model they can that still exhibits a lot of the physics that we want to understand, right? So a lot of the physics of, say, hopefully high TC superconductivity or magnetism, other things that can come out of this model, right? And then just another bit of jargon that people often, you'll hear people say, is they'll talk about half filling, okay? So what does that mean? That means that the number of electrons equals the number of sites. So the picture is, like, you know, that doesn't specify what spins they have, but it's, unless stated otherwise, it usually means that you you work in the total SZ equals zero sector. So you put in an equal number of spin ups and spin downs. Right? So this is what people mean by half filling. And the reason it's half is because this is just half the states that the system sort of has, right? You could also fill in, you know, you could also doubly occupy all these, but then it would just be a very boring system. Everything would be sort of quenched, and there'd sort of be no room for things to hop around, and, you know, and all the interactions would just sort of be fully, you know, paid and everything, and it wouldn't really do much, right?
You get interesting physics. You get like half filling plus or minus an electron.
Yeah, actually, yeah, thanks for mentioning that. Right, so half filling is important because it's the starting point really for doping, okay? So that's, again, a big motivation for studying the Hubbard model is to study the effects of doping. So this is where people start substituting one atom for another in small amounts. And this will change, this will basically, you can think of it as like removing electrons from the system sort of a few at a time. Or you can also think of adding, it just depends on which atoms they dope with. So doping, yeah, is where you move away from half filling gradually. Okay, so it's just good to have those terms straight because they come up a lot. So we're basically out of time, but so I don't, maybe I shouldn't go way into this because it's better to be all safe for one discussion. So tomorrow we'll talk about basically some different limits of the Hubbard model. So what happens basically, what's the story with some of this dimensionality and lattice details, say when you turn off U, right? There's some important effects, you know, near the limit of U is basically almost zero. Actually, you know, it's not really ever, I guess, that U is really zero in some sense. It's more that T could be bigger, way bigger than U. That's usually maybe more the situation. So in that limit where sort of T dominates, and also we'll think about this limit where U is basically infinity, T is basically going to zero, and what happens there, and we'll see some sort of interesting contrasts, and then go through maybe some different cases on specific lattices. Yeah,
question. Are we going to do Nagarjuna's theorem?
I wasn't really going to do it in super detail. I may just flash it and just mention that because I think that physics is a bit controversial as far as I understand still. I mean, it's not controversial mathematically, but whether it leads to a stable phase.
Right.
So it might be a bit of like an angel on the head of a pin situation, but it's an interesting, this is what I mean about there's a lot we don't know about the Hubbard model, right? So there's a few things we know, and then we don't always know how much they generalize. So.